Okay.
Last section, we've been talking a little bit about philosophers and such, and so this section, we're going to continue on with that. And we're going to look at some of the scientific things that influence and some of the philosophers that go along with that. Okay, and so when you really talk about the scientific revolution, we really start talking about it in about 1543. Now, that doesn't mean that science hadn't been going on. In fact, the science had been going on in a lot of other things. But where you really, this is really where it starts to really take off. And the person that it really starts to take off with is Copernicus. And basically, he proposed that the sun and not the earth was the center of the solar system. Okay, that was radical for his day. Now, if you look at some of the other science groups that were going on out there, Chinese, Mayans, and assorted other things, this was old hat, right? This was well known. Same thing as the Earth was flat type of thing, right? So there's a lot of other people out there that were doing science as well. But when you look at it in Western civilization, that's a big issue, all right? And it's the first, as Freud called it, it's the first big blow to the human ego. And here's the real deal, because now humans aren't the center of the universe, all right? And that's a real problem, okay? The problem for Copernicus is that his physics were bad, all right? It was based on Aristotle, and his data didn't support the system basically any better than the old stuff did, okay? And, of course, he was tried for heresy and killed, all right? Galileo comes along, okay? And basically was a better presenter than Copernicus, right? And supported it with new physics, made much better sense, on and on and on. Used the telescope, which was recently developed, all right? And basically showed that the moon and the other bodies that were out there were no more heavenly than Earth. Had lots of holes on it. Had lots of mountains. Had lots of other stuff. Okay? Just like Earth. Interesting. Okay? His problem, couldn't shake the notion that the planets or orbits were circular. And that was his problem. Okay? And that changed, of course, as we all know, Galileo had to go in front of the Pope and on recant and all the other stuff. And that all changed with Kepler. And Kepler basically identified that the planets were elliptical and not circular. So if we have our planet here, here's our little Earth here, okay? And here's our sun. We'll just make this the sun. Okay, here's our sun. For Copernicus and Galileo, the planets went around in a circle like that. That was a problem from a physics standpoint, because they didn't do that. What Kepler showed was that the planet orbits were like this. And by using an ellipse rather than a circle, you are now able to predict significantly better when X, Y, or Z should occur. And lo and behold, it came to pass. And we have today. And that solved Galileo's problem, and the rest, as they say, the rest is history. Bacon. When you talk about Bacon, Bacon is really credited with really the development of beginning of systematic research. All right? And a systematic empirical research. And what he believed was that learning could be only advanced through kind of a study or the inductive study of nature. By some things that we had talked about before. Who talked about these? What philosophers had talked about this before?
Aristotle,
okay? And basically, sensory observation and experience, collect facts, careful experimentation, stuff that we had heard about from the Greeks and the Romans many, many years before. Okay? So the wise ones. Okay? Philosophy should investigate nature in a wholly naturalistic, mentalistic way, and using a variety of different methods to get there. And lo and behold, you should do that collect facts unguided by a biasing hypothesis until you can draw some simple generalization. Gee, isn't that what we do in psychology today? To a degree, yeah. All right. So this is really where you start seeing a lot of the basic stuff that we talk about today. Okay. Of course, for us as psychologists, and a lot of people in science as well, a lot of this really revolves, and the big change comes around Descartes. Okay. And ultimately, Descartes is the person who really develops a framework with which basically all of the philosophers, psychologists have worked ever since. All right, and he develops a thing that we call dualism. All right, and basically he makes a distinction between the mind. Remember, where was the mind before Descartes? The mind is the soul, right, and the body. All right. And he's also an interactionist. That is, the body can affect the mind, and the mind can affect the body. And lo and behold, he's doing this in a variety of different contexts. So what's the mind? It's the same as the soul. It's the part that thinks. And a principal site of activity is in the head, not the heart, a la... We talked about the heart as being the soul, primary purpose, or primary spot. It was Roman. Galen, all right. Okay, the body, on the other hand, is basically a machine. It's an extended substance. And it's mechanical. All right, and if you look at the body, you know, he's looking at the fountains in France and how the fountains did sorts of things. And they would have all this, the water would come up at nice and things, and how did that all happen? Well, that's what he's using as a model to help guide the body, okay? And since animals had no minds, that is the soul, they were nothing more than a machine. So Fido and Fifi are basically nothing more than little machines wandering around in the wilderness. And I think cats have not changed since then. I don't care if you're a cat lover, tough. Okay. So anyway. And so he comes up with this idea of reflexes, right? And we have two types, of course, involuntary and voluntary reflexes. So involuntary reflexes are basically set up by, are basically muscles and your senses are basically connected by a complex set of nerves and assorted other things. And what he does is basically you have these animal spirits out there, right? Remember, it's a mechanism, it's a structure, all right? And it makes them possible for reactions to take place. And so the classic example is if you step on a stick. The nerves send a signal to the brain, the brain releases an animal spirit, which is a nerve, which goes into a nerve, causes it to muscle to swell, causes the foot to be pulled up off the stick. So he's using that water fountain model that he saw as the way to do this, all right? They don't know about neuroelectrical chemical synapses at that time, all right? And this was an interesting way of doing it. So, and it made a lot of sense, all right? So what you're going to be doing is you're going to have some stuff. Going to step on it, send a signal. How does that signal happen, though? He didn't really resolve that issue. But he does talk about how to get the stuff to cause it to happen. Okay? So you have also voluntary reflexes, though. Okay? So, but those were more problematic, right? Because you have the mind and body are separate. Okay? So how do you do it? Well, the answer was you had to have some kind of mechanism to connect them both. All right? And so, for Descartes, that was the pineal gland, because it connected both a lot of the neural structures with a lot of the brain structure, with a lot of the stuff. And basically what he contended was that the pineal was a container. Okay, it was like a container. And basically it was filled with fluid, okay, for these animal spirits. And so you tip the pineal in the right direction, fluid would flow down those nerves to those muscles to cause your leg to move or whatever it was. Okay? And the soul, of course, pushed those in the right directions. And of course, when you did that, your right muscles moved and all the other stuff. So think about this. Think about you writing in your pencil, with your pencil there. To make you write well, your pineal has to adjust to get those fluids down in all those right nerves to make it work well. And lo and behold, that's what he talked about. So pineal is the connecting system for the mind, all of the soul, and the body, the mechanisms, all right? And of course, he talks about consciousness, defines psychology as the body of the science that studies consciousness, and on and on and on. So remember, Descartes is a very spiritual guy. He's not one of these people that are the heretics, so to speak, from the Christian faith. He's a philosopher, scientist of his day. Okay. Well, we move on. And where we really begin to start to get the change that's going to influence psychology and learning, especially what we're talking about today, okay, is the British Associations. All right? And the British Associations are going to have huge impacts for psychology and also for learning theorists. And the first one of these is Locke. And Locke is contended, although other people start talking about science, etc., Locke is really considered to be the father of empiricism. Okay? He's a physician, a politician, and on and on and on. And he was less in the grip of a lot of the stuff of Descartes than other people. Okay? Basically what Locke says is this. Your mind is basically a white sheet of paper upon which all experience writes. That's a blank slate. Or what we also call a tabula rasa. And who talked about that? It's back in the thing in my head. Who is it?
Aristotle.
Okay. All right, so basically what Locke's point is that all ideas come from experience, all right? You basically start with a blank slate, and all the ideas and everything that comes into you, it comes into you through experience. So you're starting blank. Everyone starts blank. Okay? Now, it's like Aristotle's, but the way that Locke developed it, it's totally on his own, all right? And Locke is also really what we call the first associationist. And basically what he's identifying or whatever it is associationism, is basically where you take and you combine and compound ideas. So you one idea just doesn't stop. It adds on to another idea, and a third idea, and on and on and on. And this is going to be expounded on by a lot of later theorists, including the scientists up to today. Okay? So Locke is really the first one. When you first talk about the British Associationists, he's really the first one. And if you all get an opportunity, you should go back and read some stuff about from Locke. It's very fascinating stuff. Hobbes, he's also an empiricist. But basically he also contends that trains of thought, all right, are guided. They're guided by desires and purpose, and others are unguided. So the classic example is when you are having thoughts about whatever. Some of it is just random, all right? It's just floating all over the place. Others' thoughts are very guided. One, move to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, all right? So when I'm tying a fishing fly, okay? It's a classic example, all right? I'm tying a fishing fly. There's a very precise procedure which I tie a fishing fly, okay? You have to get all the equipment, you take a hook and you put it in the little vise and you snip, put it there. And you have to wrap the string around it and you put the feathers on it to make it do certain shapes and all these other kinds of things that go with that. It's a very logical sequence. And if you do it wrong, you end up with a mess, okay? And if anybody has ever tied fishing flies, you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't tie it correctly, then the wings are down, or that they're falling all over the place, or you throw it in the water and all the feathers come off. I mean, it's, it, you know, so it's got to be very guided. It's very specific. Hobbes talks about the same kind of thing with thoughts. It's the same kind of things. You move from one thought into the next thought to the next thought. Okay. So Hobbes is really the first one that begins to talk about motivating factors. And motivation, a theory of motivation that we talk about today, is a lot different than the motivation that we talk about from the time of Hobbes. Berkeley, okay, didn't believe in the existence of material substance at all right? The mind is the only real reality out there. And he denied that the mind even pictures objects at all. Okay, so we never sense depth. We never sense a lot of the other kinds of things directly. You're always using cues out there to help yourself. Hume, okay, Locke basically eliminated from experience, but others accept the existence of objects. Hume basically, and Berkeley denies existence of objects at all. And Hume takes the next step, and that is questions the existence of God and the soul, etc. So if you question, if you're from a philosophical standpoint, if you're questioning that God even exists, which of course for his time is what? That's pretty bad stuff, right? Okay. So now, if you don't have God, now only what you have are sensations and ideas. And so ultimately, remember when I talked about Bonaventure starting some of that initial stuff and Aquinas, and it starts to make that separation. Now here you're really getting the true separation completely out. Not only there's overlap up to now. Now what's basically saying is there's no God at all. It's all of this. It's all sensations. It's all ideas, etc. And of course, makes a clean distinction between sensations and ideas, which are ultimately called images. Okay. And they are the things that cause you and have effects on everything that you do. Okay? Okay. So, what we're talking about here now is a progression of one to another to another to another as we're moving into the scientific revolution. And those philosophers and where they're coming from. Right? Now, was there kickback? Absolutely. Is there kickback today? Absolutely. Okay? That's what it's about. Alright? Okay? Alright. So, Hartley. Two concepts. Really, really important. Association and psychophysical parallelism. So what's association? Okay? He takes materials from Locke and Berkeley and Hume, and sensations and actions as well. Basically, associations are used to explain the nature, memory, imagination, and other emotional concepts. Lots of different things, okay? Psychophysical parallelism are basically the ideas that ideas and sensations and assorted other things can basically run along parallel to each other, but they're not directly influenced by other events. Okay, so think about it like a nature body thing. All right, changes in the nerves, changes in the brain, and on and on and on, and that's what you're getting. Okay, so he's not an interactionist like some of the other ones, and ultimately these are the things that began to start. That ideas, mental events, sensations, etc., they're not influenced by other things that are out there. Okay? These can be independent in and of themselves. So you can have a sensation out there of love, whatever love is, all right? That's totally independent about a bunch of other stuff. Okay? So you begin to start to, here is where you're starting to have multiple things that can be going simultaneously, but not being interacting within each other. Mill Mill goes on from this, and basically what Mill says is this: ideas run together. Okay, ideas run together. One thought and idea leads to another idea, leads to a third idea. And basically, simple ideas by association run together and form complex ideas. So what you're going to start is you're going to have a bunch of simple ideas, and you're going to move into a more complex idea. Okay? And basically, one idea is capable of entering into combinations with other ideas. And so basically, complex ideas consists of lots of simple ideas. So basically, you're adding up in there. And that's going to have an impact ultimately in Gestalt psychology, where you talk about the whole and some of the parts and assorted other things. All right? John Stuart Mill, all right? And what he basically does is he takes that information and expands on it. And he contends that simple ideas create complex ideas, but are even more, they're more than the sum of the parts. And that's really what really impacts. So John Mill begins to talk about, in essence, Gestalt psychology, but John Stuart Mill is really the one that's going to take that and make it into what, he doesn't make it into Gestalt psychology, but that's what the Gestalt psychologists will begin to use for a lot of other things. Now, I'm going to give you an example of how this goes on. And you've seen me do this, and so you can kind of support me. I'm out there, I'm sitting in there, I'm talking with somebody about a research idea, whatever those research ideas. And I go, let's go out to the whiteboard. Okay? And I start talking about an idea and I write it down. And we're talking about a research design or something like that. And we come up with another one right there. And a third one and a fourth one. We come up with a whole series of studies that we can do X, Y, and Z and doing all of that. And where does this come from? It starts with one simple idea, then expands on into multiple others' ideas. And that's really what it's about. It relates to what we call spreading activation in cognitive psychology, if you've ever heard of that, where one point causes an explosion of ideas or concepts that go along with that. The thing is, it all revolves around some particular concept, whatever that particular concept is. And you do that too, okay? I think you get better at that when you get older, okay? Especially if you're in academia, and basically where you basically may be focusing on one particular study or whatever. I'm not looking at one study, I'm looking at a series of studies. How does this impact that? What is going on with this? How could this impact? We test that, and on and on and on. Okay. And from there you then move on, and that's what we call psychology and science. Right? Okay, so those are a lot of the British associationists. But they're not the only ones that are out there that are going to have an impact in all of this. And so we begin to move into sensory psychology and sensory physiology. And these are the things that are going to be becoming huge in what we call physiology today and what we call sensory psychology today. And so let's talk about a few of these.
Okay.
All right? It takes Descartes' work, and basically it goes far beyond that into where we are today. Okay? It's analytical, subjective, and on and on and on. And so ultimately, all what you begin to see is you start to get in detail of all the different major physiological sensory systems that we talk about today. Okay? This is the stuff that gets nerve speed. This is the stuff that does a lot of other things. Lots of contributors here. Newton, classical example, puts the laws in motion. That basically, the universe is a machine. All right, and if you take it and go into some of the other philosophies, more of the Far Eastern philosophies, that the universe expands and contracts. And has always expanded and contracted ever since the beginnings of time. Okay? That's part of that. So basic physiologists and sensory psychologists, sensory physiologists, etc. First one is Helmholtz. This guy is absolutely brilliant. And basically contributes, talks about the fields of vision. He's the guy that developed the ophthalmoscope. So what you go in is you go into the doctor and they look in your eye with that little thing. They look at, and they're basically looking at the retina and a lot of the other things, the optic nerve and a sort of other things. He's the guy that made that. He develops the trichromatic theory of color. So basically that you have three colors, you take all the colors, you put it together, and you can make any color in the universe. Okay? That's trichromatic theory. And we know that our brain, that your brain functions on that. And when you throw on the other theory called the Ponant process, you basically can understand how you can visualize every color dimension. Yeah.
What three colors?
Red, blue, and green. Yeah. So you can basically make any color with those three. There's another one that we also have in your system. It's yellow. And so it's red, green, blue, yellow. And those relate to the cones that you have in your eye and how they process information. We're not going to go into that, but yellow is its own little interesting thing. Okay, develops place theory in the sensory system in the ear. Place theory basically says is that each part of your cochlea has a spot that's directly responsible for you to perceive a particular pitch or tone or actually frequency. Okay. You damage that part, it goes away. Okay? And it does. It goes away over time. So, for example, in my age group, although I'm a little different because I've really protected my hearing over the years, I can still hear really pretty high pitches. Okay? You hear that, what's that? Is it the mouse thing or the mouse pitch? The mosquito, yeah. I can still hear the mosquito a lot better. I can hear the mosquito down really low. For most people in my age, your age group, you can all hear it. I can even hear it down four or five levels down. Okay, it's I'm just weird because I protected my hearing. But a lot of you can't hear it because of the loud music and assorted other things that you have damaged because of that. Okay, so that's place theory. Identifies the functions of the ossicles and on and on and on. Fechner. Quantitative psychology, this guy's the one that really makes everything you all are having to do today. This is what you can blame Fechner for all of this. Okay, so develops the elements of psychophysics and basically looking at physiological stimuli and psychological properties. So pitch and how you perceive that. Okay, or loudness and on and on and on. Okay? And you can put that to a logarithm and you can understand that. Okay, so it really, really, really important. Okay? And basically shows that you can measure this stuff. And that's going to have a huge impact, and it's had a huge impact. And that's what you have to deal with within sensation and perception and assorted other courses that we know of today. Okay? This becomes experimental psychology that you know. Right, and out of this comes a lot of other fields, okay. So, including the field of learning. So, that's kind of some of the people, major players, up into those. And then next time we're going to start getting into some of the schools. So, start reading up a little bit on those. The schools of psychology really are the ones that change the way that we begin as psychologists to think. And these are the ones that are going to have a huge impact, not only in relation to what we learn from a historical standpoint, but from the approaches that we're taking to examining problems today. And so go back in your book and read that section on schools of psychology and the major ones, and be ready for those on the next time we meet. So until then, have yourself a great day, and look forward to seeing you soon.